All right, sit down. You want to relax, please? Please relax. I prefer it on my lap. Thank you. Miffy's not here, so I can do what I like.
When you fidget with it, it makes funny noises. That's all.
I know that.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Just making sure.
So we need to put up with the funny noises. I know that. I understand. I'll try not to fiddle. So we start as usual with our little kind of prayer, putting us in the right direction. The lamas always call it setting a motivation. And I think that's not how we talk. Hello, there. No, don't be sorry. Sit down, grab a chair. But I think we might say, what's our purpose? So it really is the point. What's our purpose? I mean, why are we here? What's the point? Well, you know, it's to listen. That really does include me, I promise, to these words coming from to the Tibetan tradition, my teachers, coming from the Buddha, you know. And it's advice. It's all advice. Every word of it's advice. It's not. It's a load of rubbish. It has to be advice. Which means it should be practical to do what? Well, I love the analogy, repeat it all the time, to develop the two wings of a bird, you know, wisdom and compassion. So compassion is the point, finally, but it's as funny as Dalai Lama always says, it's not enough. You've got to have wisdom. So wisdom wing is the nuts and bolts of the work of being a Buddhist that we apply in our own lives, you know, putting ourselves together, making ourselves a bit workable and a bit useful, you know, lessening our neuroses and becoming a bit more content and therefore a bit wiser and therefore more related to others. And so it's this four visual thoughts one, which we've been doing all week, is the compassion wing, really. But if it's the contingent upon success of the wisdom wing, then somehow it always gets back to that, you know. So let's see what we discuss. I'm not quite sure yet. So we sing our little prayer. Two lines. The first two lines are expressing, for those of us who kind of figure we're kind of Buddhists already, reiterating our reliance on the Buddha and his teachings. And the second two lines express this motivation that we listen to these teachings so we can develop our amazing potential, so we can finally be of benefit to others, you know, to develop this extraordinary potential that the Buddha would say that we've all got, something like that, roughly like that. So we think that's why we're here together. And then even if, as I say, even if there's 1% of what you hear that's useful, that's fantastic. You can be a 1% of this. So I'll sing it in Tibetan over prayer. Sangye charam soke chognam la jam shu badu dagni kyab su chi dagi tern yen di personam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok sangye charam soke chognam la jam shu badu dagni kyab su chi dagi tern yen di personam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok Sangye charam soke chognam la chang chu badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chon yen gi pe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok. All right. So every time you think about, you know, the explicit beneficiary of the wisdom wing or the Buddha's advice is to help us oneself get rid of our suffering and develop some kind of contentment and fulfillment, you know. That's the explicit, we're the explicit beneficiary. But inevitably, it's going to be helpful to others. As Lama Zopa says, if you decide not to kill and steal and lie, or not to kill, for example, because you don't want future suffering, which is the Buddha's deal, then guess what? You're the beneficiary. The rats and cockroaches will definitely have a party. You leave them in peace, you know. The compassion wing, explicitly it's there to sort of help others, but still you're the beneficiary too. I always say this one, when I first heard all these teachings in Buddhism about the levels of compassion that we're capable of accomplishing, which are pretty outrageous, like knowing to become a saint, and that's not normal daily life, you know. It seemed impossible, it seemed unattainable, it seemed too high to me. And then I heard the Dalai Lama say, you know, if you want to help others, practice compassion. If you want to help yourself, practice compassion. It kind of gave me a leg up, you know. I said, okay, that makes sense. So one of the ways to be beneficial to others, there's different ways, is the first way, and this is again the very beginning, the wisdom one, is control your body and speech. This is the very first level of practice. You know, we all think Buddhism's about the mind, and it is. And that's where you really start to do the work. Be your own therapist, as Mummy, she says. But we've got to do some work before that. And that is, you know, control the servants of the mind. Mama's able to call them the slaves of the mind. And what are they? Your body, your actions, your physical actions in relation to others, and your speech in relation to others. So again, the crucial point in the Buddhist view of karma, which comes into the wisdom wing, which is the basis, the starting point of practice, it's to stop doing actions that harm others. But we've got to get the point first, the main beneficiary first. What Buddha's trying to get us to see first is it's for your own benefit. Why? Because everything we think and do and say produces the personality trauma. And I think we really miss this piece in our culture. Because it says don't kill, it seems like being a nice ethical person not to harm others is true. But the first point to get is that you are the beneficiary of that. Because that's the method for you to stop future suffering. Because guess what? We all create our own suffering and our own happiness. This is huge in Buddhism. This is a fundamental point about the law of karma. You're the beneficiary of that. Then, of course, you do less harm to others. You are first. So one of the things that I think for most of us, in the people in this room, we might not go around killing and raping and stealing too often, but look at our speech. Look at the trouble we cause with speech. Forget to ourselves, but look at the harm it does to others. So, you know, there's four main things Buddha would exhort us not to do. Don't say words that aren't true. Don't just rabble on about nothing and make people bored to tears. Don't use harsh language. And don't bad mouth behind backs. This, I think, is our favorite because you feel safe doing it. There's someone else and they start to agree with you, and you're bad mouthing your mum, you're bad mouthing your sister, you're bad mouthing, you know, the politicians, you're bad mouthing your friends at work, you're bad mouthing your friends at the Buddhist Center. You know, it's one of the commonest things on the planet. To find fault in other people. So it's a minefield too, because then you think, well, I'm not supposed to say anything. And there's, you know, someone kicking the dog and I shouldn't criticize. Or there's a war in Ukraine. Or I shouldn't say it's a war. No, that's ridiculous. That's not chucking the baby out of the bathwater. So there are two things there. There are things that are wrong. You see something happening that's wrong, immoral, unethical, someone harming another. You can point it out, but it's got, you know, but what we do, we then add anger to it. And that's what we don't realize that they're different things. So when we think, don't be angry, we think, oh, well, there's really no war in Ukraine. It's really all right. I've got to be all lovey-dovey. That's ridiculous. Same as a war in Ukraine. Is a fact. That's not anger, and we can't see the difference. Having a pain in your knee is true, it's painful. But we assume, well, of course I'm angry, I've got a pain in my knee. Of course I'm angry with that guy, he kicked the dog. We really think these come together, they're the same, but once we understand they're not, it's a revelation. So that's one thing. But the speech one, when it comes to us working closely together. Now, I always use an example of my sisters, my brother and my sisters. And I'm not trying to say we're saints, but it's such a real example. There's six of us. I always say there's seven, but one died 6 weeks ago, so I'm going to get used to saying there's six of us now. But we're not saints. I'm not saying that. But somehow, well, there we were, seven kids in the family, all very close in age, you know, all very bossy. My brother's at the seventh one, poor brother, the seven bossy sisters, you know. We're all kind of bossy types. It's good quality being a bossy type. And, you know, very verbal. Well, not all of us, actually. So we were living very close together. We ran out of beds because we had so many babies so quickly. And, you know, there's lots of kids together. And that's what happens. Kids are all together. So there's lots of emotion, lots of drama, you know. Then we'd all grow up and we went home, come home for Christmas. And, you know, you'd talk, you'd fight. There was never schisms in the family. We kind of always forgave each other because, you know, pretty fundamental our harmony. But, you know, you can't keep saying things. We know the damage of speech, you know. So somehow in the last years, I don't know how many, more old now, there's kind of been this unspoken agreement that we do not say bad words about each other to each other on the phone or FaceTime or whatever we do, which is really common. Because when you're with friends and family, you talk about each other. But sometimes because we're upset and struggling with your sister Polly, so as soon as you see Judy, you blurt it out the mouth. We know this. Because we don't, and I'd say the reason is because we don't know how to really handle it in ourselves. We have a therapist, that's the person actually to talk to. But what we do it to our friends. Then we have problems at work, and the trouble at work that the company keeps. You can't wait to talk to someone else about the mean boss, about the ugly colleague. And the Buddha said it's just the same. And I mean, I happen to go to a lot of the centers. We're no different just because we're labeled Buddhist doesn't mean we're saints. The amount of disharmony because people disarm you. Not even argue, talk behind backs, you know. So with our family, it's very fascinating. We don't see each other that often, we speak on phone and blah, blah, blah. But what's fascinating, because we're sort of fairly stick to this. So when you're not saying the bad words, when you do talk, you're finding good things to say. And even now, typically siblings, when we're young, we take each other's boyfriends and cheat and be mean and, you know, just you do things like that, although you love each other. But now, when I look at it, it's quite astonishing. I'm not saying these things. But there's literally more affection because you create the space for the affection. A friend of mine in Santa Fe, when I was talking to one of my sisters on FaceTime, she was shocked at how kind I was to my sister, kind of rejoicing. When we rejoice about each other to each other, we praise each other to each other. It's really quite, it's astonishing. Speech is incredible. But what I think in our culture, so talk about compassion, there's an active compassion. As well as discipline for yourself, a disciplined practice of yours, wouldn't we? But I think in our culture, you know, one of the major things that we think, which is prevents us from trying to think it's important to control our speech, is because we think we have this feeling, we have a very kind of moralistic view of what we can and can't do. And because we have this strong sense that someone's bossing us somewhere, it's either God or mummy or daddy or the judge or some vague sense of they, whoever they are, or your boss, your grandma. Someone's always telling us don't do that. So as soon as we hear kind of, let's say, spiritual teachings, don't do this and don't do that, the assumption is if I do it, I'm naughty and I'll get punished. We assume there's a punisher. We assume that. So then we sort of think, well, I'm allowed to say what I like. Like it's a righteousness, you know, I'm allowed to say what I like. You're not going to tell me what to do. That's how we feel. That's what our view of ethics and morality is. It's quite shocking. The Buddha's view is this natural law. The fundamentals in ethics in Buddhism are the same as Jesus. They even got a list of 10 each. Jesus said, don't do this, don't build, don't steal, don't jump on the wrong partner. Same kind of stuff, you know. But the difference in the basis is incredible. I'm not being rude. I'm not being rude about it. The Christian view is, and I asked my dear priest friend, I'm sorry, about that 2 days ago, I can't remember, that a sin by definition, a negative action by definition, is one that God said not to do. It's exactly the same in your mother's house. Don't do that. And you're being a smarty pants. Why not? We know mummy's answer. Because I say so. So that's our view of morality and ethics. It's this very dualistic system that there's a bunch of people out there who are the police, like the police, you know, the police, the judge, the grandma, grandpa, mummy, daddy, God, who lay down the laws, and then the assumption is punishment and reward. This is the dualistic view we have in our bones about ethics and morality. Don't blame your Jewish mother or your Catholic mother for this. It's a function of ego grasping for the Buddha. We made it up. Now, the Buddha says don't kill as well as Jesus. And his reason is completely different. Because it's a natural law. Guess what? People don't like getting killed. Do your market research and you'll check pretty carefully. It's natural law. The priest told me, he's a friend, he said there is some aspect of natural law, but the main thing that makes it wrong is because God said. This is tremendous, and I'm not criticizing. If you live your life that way, you live a good life. But it's not the Buddha's view. So Buddha says, so why does Buddha, okay, so then this is the point. Why does he say don't kill me? First, he establishes in the beginning the heaviest of negative actions, which are one that harm others. And they're negative because others get harmed, others don't like it. It's a natural law. You can prove it. But this is the point. He exhorts us not to do it first, especially because it'll harm us. It'll harm us. So forget that piece here. Let's look at the harm it does to others, especially the one I speak to now. There's this wonderful meditation I love to do. I mean, I'll do it on the weekend. If you're going to be coming, then I don't know. But there's a lot of this, we call it blessing the speech. It's the most delicious little meditation. And it's so hilarious when you say the Sanskrit syllable, you said to be very pure. And you're kind of imagining your tongue as like this sweet dedication prayer about the tongue. It sounds hilarious. I love it, I tell you. But the point of it is about speech. Okay, let's talk about this. So the very first thing, as I said, the Buddha exhorts to stop to kill, steal, lie. And then it's three things of the body, and then four of the speech. And the first reason, the first one, is for our own benefit. Because everything we think and do and say reduces the person we become. So if we do negative things, angry things, resentful things, jealous things, we are hurting ourselves. We really do sincerely miss this in our culture. We just hear it as moralistic. I'm naughty, miss it completely. But let's look at the aspect of it, at the function it has to harm others, the troubles it causes. So the thing is, hearing the thing about speech, I think the other thing that's a problem for us is that we kind of think of ourselves as one big lump, and this big lump of me kind of plodding through life. We know we have speech, we know we have body, we know we have mind, thoughts, three things, but it's sort of this big lump of me, We don't really, and certainly we don't think of spiritual practice as controlling the speech. So we think that's terrible. We think, but why? Because we only have two options in life. We vomit everything out or we suppress. So it seems awful. And in fact, we make a great fuss about our speech and we call it sharing. Oh, I think it's so wicked. I can't tell you. I think that is the wickedest thing. Oh, it's called sharing. So I'm having a problem with my sister. So I share it with another sister. I mean, there's one abusive speech, which is sharing your anger with each other. That's about the worst thing to be possible also. As the last person you should talk to about your anger is the person you're angry with, actually. We think it's noble. We think it's good. There's another whole discussion here. I want to talk. Well, both of them we need to discuss, actually. But the one that seems to be the most destructive somehow is the one that's the fourth one, the one that, criticizing people, finding faults. Speaking the thoughts, as long as I've put them, speaking the thoughts of other people, like I said, sister, brother, friend, colleague. And then, and so the main trouble from that one is the disharmony it causes, the disharmony it causes. We know that. I mean, we know that. But so why is it so hard? That's what we have to look at. Why is it so hard? So this is the point about Buddhist practice. The real job of being a Buddhist is when it's like, if you know the labyrinth, when you start at the middle scope and you start to look at your mind, start to identify attachment and anger and the delusions. When you're really then getting bullseye into actual real practice. You become a Buddhist when you start working on your mind. That's the Buddhist, a unique approach, but it's not the first step. That's why the very first one is about behavior. Even that word sounds so peculiar, behavior, your body and your speech. So you look at the world, just generally, we see people harm each other. The violence, the lying, the stealing, the killing, the raping, the torturing, the dropping of bombs. They're actions of body and speech, aren't they? The actions of the body and speech. Can you imagine if we first had junior school, entry level, grade one level of practice? Harness the energy of our body and speech and refrain from doing things to others. The world would be a blissful place. It's just outrageously evident, Your family, and like I'm saying with our family, we don't live together, but still it's given because we're refraining from saying the things about each other or refraining, especially when you come as a group and the couple might have a bit of a wine, a little bit tipsy, your mouth a bit loose, then dramas happen. Tears and crying. You push it, forgive each other the next day. But look at the exhaustion you go through to get there. So the absence of it is not, it's not depressing. You're being adult. You're finding common ground. So we have plenty to talk about without having to argue. You know, plenty. And when you leave, when you give that space, it, more comes, more virtue can come, more pleasure can come, more fun can come. And you go home and you have nothing to regret. We look at the torture ourselves of the regret that we had when we did that fight. We know this is a pain for ourselves. So why is it so difficult, the thing? Why is it so difficult? Because I think that it's so difficult. First, because we don't have a really powerful sense of cause and effect, the way Buddha does, that everything we think and do and say, even not to mention to others now, but to ourselves, have consequences. That is the very process itself of producing the person I become. It's the very process itself of programming me into the person I become. So if I'm going to be spad-mouthing people, lying to people, saying things that are wrong for people, gossiping, rabbiting on, talking bad people about behind backs, forget from the first point, forget the harm you do to others. Look at what you're producing in yourself. This is the part that I think we really sincerely miss. We truly miss it because we hear it as moralistic. I'm allowed to say what I like, we say. That's like saying you're allowed, I'm allowed to sow any seeds in my garden that I like. You're absolutely right. You are allowed. But guess what? Seeds bring fruits. So you'd better decide which seeds you wish to plant and then refrain from planting the ones you don't want. That's the basis here. This is the part we truly miss, I think. It's not moralistic. Buddha is saying don't kill, just like Jesus. His reason is like a doctor. It's advice to you. Just like a doctor says don't smoke. Why not? And she doesn't say, because I will punish you with cancer. That's how we think of morality. I mean, it's kind of infantile, really. That's why we get guilty and neurotic. And that's why we then go home and we say, oh, the doctor's not there. Out come the wild rose, won't get cancer if he doesn't see. This is like a joke. So because no one's, because the person you're talking about isn't there, you think it's okay to do it. You might be harming them, but you're harming yourself and you're creating disharmony. So there's going to always be consequences. Whatever way you look, there's going to be consequences, being cause and effect. We have the sense of righteousness, and I'm allowed, like someone squashing me and telling me I shouldn't do something. You're not going to tell me what to do. That's how we feel. So until we really get this point that we produce ourselves, which is the way Buddha said it, I mean, they didn't say those words. But like Holiness said, karma is like self-creation. This is what it's doing. It's deep. It's massively dealt with in all the literature over the centuries. You know? It's deeply laid out in depth. It's the Buddhist view of the universe. It's the law that runs the universe, the law within which the universe runs. No one made it up and no one runs it. There's no punisher, there's no rewarder. It's a natural law. This is incredible to think about. Everything we think and do and say is the process itself that produces the person I am. That's it. So if we have any self-respect at all, first, forget the harm I've done to others, that's more advanced. Even the first one. Like if you have any self-respect at all and you know that sugar and things will cause you to get diabetes and you absolutely know you do not want diabetes, the thought of eating sugar will be revolting to you. The thought of getting lung cancer would be horrifying to you. So it's self-respect that causes you to eat properly, to not put in your body things that will cause you future suffering. This is absolutely the point behind karma, but we can't hear it like that. We hear it as moralistic, righteous, you know. That's our mistake. Look, what does that mean like that? So for our own sake first, I mean, these words are quite simple, but it shows how hard it is to see this, you know. for our own sake, we should, you know, when we really begin to get some sense of cause and effect, we wouldn't be able to bear saying angry words about somebody behind their back or in front of them for that matter. It doesn't matter. It will be painful to oneself. This is really tough one to get. We don't get this one. I'm allowed to say it. She did you that harm. I'm allowed to say it. So one of the reasons we don't have much time for us to control the body and speech up to do the harm is because we don't really get the sense of what we get. They said the bodhisattvas have the greatest compassion for sentient beings, not even because we don't realize emptiness, the ultimate reality. So if we don't realize cause and effect, then we produce ourselves. We produce the person we become. We produce our own happiness and suffering. This is quite intense, actually. And it's hard to get. But the other reason is obvious, is because we don't sort of even distinguish in speech. Sounds like a silly practice, perhaps, controlling speech. How peculiar. Why not to meditate? Well, if you can't control the servant of the anger, how in the name of heaven can you control your anger? It's fairly obvious. The speech of the servant of the speech is the obvious one to control first. The servant of the mind, the speech and the body, which is the basis of the basis of Buddhist practice, controlling good behavior, living vows. It's tremendous. It's an amazing practice. You're harnessing your own energy. As Alex Berzin calls vow, you're kind of like, you're forming your behavior. You're turning yourself into a nice person. When you learn to drive a car, you learn hundreds of things that you vow not to do. You don't turn the wheel right if you drive left. You don't put the foot on the brake at the same time as the accelerator. I mean, there are hundreds of things you must learn, the don'ts. But you don't get all suppressed. Don't you tell me what to do. I can turn the wheel left if I want to. I mean, that's ridiculous. So we know we internalize those don'ts. You become familiar with them. And what are you doing? You're producing a good car driver. Well, vows and decisions to control your behavior, the reason behind them is to produce a happy person. Nothing to do with compassion yet. It's a method for you to become a happy person. I mean, we should be so delighted. Like the doctor told you to eat nicely. How kind she is. Pointing out all the disgusting diseases. You're producing a healthy person. Well, this is what you're trying to do here. Having vows of ethics, good ethical behavior. You are the benefit. So when we know that one, we've got a reason to want to do it for our own sake. It's common sense. So the reason it's hard too is because we haven't tried to control. And of course, we can't control our mind. So when you have like a family thing and something happens, your sister says something, and then all the chatting, you're hurt because of the closeness, the hurt, you know. She said this and she said that. And because we're not used to dealing with our own problems, this is the major one. We don't know, we don't have techniques in our life. We have never been given techniques in our life. It's sort of only fairly new with Freud and psychotherapy, these methods of finding a professional person to discuss your problems with, which is very intelligent. But it's because we don't know how to deal with them ourselves, which is quite amazing, really, that we got brought up with techniques to know how to deal with our mind. This is quite shocking that we don't have them. We need to go to a professional to help me work out my feelings. It's kind of bizarre, really. Well, not okay. But the Buddha would say we can learn to do it ourselves, what practice means. So then that means understanding the Buddha's model of the mind. Very distinct model, very clear. There are neurotic, deluded, ridiculous, eye-based, fear-based, distorted, delusional, distressing states of mind. In their character are two things, deeply disturbing to oneself, distressing, and literally delusional. In English, this is a brilliant word. It's one of the words in Tibetan and Sanskrit. But in other languages, it's kind of a weird word. It's so perfect in English. It's absolutely describing exactly the function of these unhappy states of mind. It's clear that it's disturbing. Your mind's agitated. Your mind's upset, anxious, angry, jealous, depressed. It's clear they're disturbing. But the one that we don't see until we start really looking into the Buddhist model of the mind, studying it properly, that they're delusional, that all of them in their character, in their nature, these stories, these conceptual stories beneath the emotions, they exaggerate the object, they embellish. So attachment, the mother of them all, the basis, is emotional hunger, and it's always wanting something more. Then what it does is it exaggerates. The degree to which you're feeling dissatisfied is the degree to which the cake will look divine to you. Your attachment literally exaggerates its deliciousness. And then, or you're in love with Fred, the attachment exaggerates his deliciousness. It blinds you from seeing the whole person. So then when Fred starts to be mean to you, and yes, he might have been mean, that might not be a fantasy. He might really have cheated on you, in fact. But what then anger is the response, the hurt, the aching hurt of anger. How dare he do that to me? I don't deserve it. So then that anger exaggerates his horribleness. It blinds you from seeing anything else. This is how they function. When we hear these words, we can hear it's like that, but we never think of it like that. Because when you're in love with Fred, you believe he was divine, and now you're through your rose-tiled specs away, and now you have your angry specs. I understand. What?
That can actually ruin the sound file.
What?
When the scratching?
Yeah, I'll just keep it quiet.
Okay.
Can I put it
in the back?
No, no, I want to hold it.
Okay, all right, no. Miffy
instructions. I know Miffy is telling you what to do.
Okay.
Miffy's not here.
She can hear you.
That's her problem.
Okay. All right.
Oh, well, we'll leave it there. And yes. I might touch it occasionally. But it's when the wires get all caught up, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think when it gets twisted, it says,
well, I touch it like that, it doesn't matter. Like that.
So you can hear a little bit sometimes. Yeah.
This way, when the wires get all.
It's just the recording gets messed up.
I understand all the reasons. But look, stop doing it now.
It has a mind of its own. It does it occasionally.
I know I'm being stubborn.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, Mickey. I know if it's here. You have a mental breakdown. I'm sorry, Mickey. I'm causing you problems. Well, thank you for giving me the job to do. Okay. Are we communicating so far?
Yeah.
Are we recognizing?
Yeah.
It's familiar. Yeah. Nothing fancy and new. Okay. So the problem follows because the speech is uncontrolled, because we can't handle it. We have to blurt it out our mouth, I think, because we don't have techniques to, as Lama would put it, be our own therapist. We're not practiced enough in talking, being our own friend. You understand? Even if you do go to your sister to try and sort out the problems with the other sister, that's better. You know, you can even show you're being angry and you're hurt and you're crying. And if your other sister wants to help you with it, that can be productive. But the usual one is just blah. You know? And then everybody, because we all believe what we're told, that person, you're going to poison their mind. You start taking sides. Then politics happens. Then schisms. Divorces. You know, and that eventually brings wars and divisions in groups and countries in the future, can't we? And in Buddhist organizations. So the thing is, if we first then, given that our mind is deluded, given that we still do have attachment and anger, and given that we've got negative karma that's going to pop up like a big lump sometimes out of the blue, unexpectedly, we get kind of swept along by the storms of karma, you know. At least if we can make a decision. Every morning, you make a decision. You make a decision. I'm going to watch my speech like a hawk. Like anything, it's hard. Like any habit, it's difficult to change it. But we have the potential. As the Tibetans would put it, nothing ever gets more difficult with practice. We say practice makes perfect. There's a bit sort of perfectionist, isn't it? But it's more humble. Nothing ever gets more difficult with practice. But the reason to do something, the only reason that you'll do something is if you see there's a benefit. So unless you feel there's some benefit to you, and we don't in the world, we think it doesn't matter what I say. We really say those words, meaning we don't understand the consequences to ourselves, and we think are allowed to say whatever we like, because we don't think as well, especially if no one else hears us say it, then it sort of it doesn't matter. We really feel that, you know. But if you can see the benefit to oneself first oneself, this is really hard. And it's tremendously hard because the energy is like a bomb inside, isn't there? Because we don't know how to deal with the stories in there. We feel the hurt. We feel what the person did. We're convinced we're right. She did this and she did that and he did this and he did that. And there might be some truth in it, but it's very hard when you're seeing it through the lenses of anger. You can't tell facts from fiction. But even if it is right, they did the certain things. What compels us to say it behind their back is because we're angry, we're hurt, and we're angry with them. She did this and he did that, and how dare he do this? And then we talk, and then we build up a story. We know this. Look at families. I mean, as a family I know that is broken into three groups, not just two. They don't harm each other. They don't beat each other. It's speech. I remember in the 70s when I was in one of our centres, one of the first centres of Lovey Issues I was ever started in England, after Chen Raising Institute. The first one after Kopan was Tushita and Damsala. The next one was Chen Raising Institute in Yudla. The next one was Manjushri Institute in England. And I was, after I became a nun in 77, I went there. And Lama started Wisdom Publications there and other things. And I lived there. And it was like hell. This war zone happened. It's like a schism. And this is what you have to understand karma, you know. We don't think this way in the West. You know, in a relationship, you're beloved. This is really, it's so fascinating. Forget your sisters and set the love business. But you've got a beloved. You have a beloved. You're in love with each other. And you're married, whatever. And then somehow, you start to find fault. You start to get upset, angry. You might talk behind their back or talk directly and fight. And before you know it, you look at the bed and you think, who is this destructive person next to me? We know that. And it's hard to see. And then we kind of keep thinking, well, if you don't fight so much, suddenly it starts to become distant. Suddenly projections start. But we keep thinking, what happened? We can't work it out. Well, actually, maybe nothing happened. But karma, right? It's like this. Karma's like that. Mithy's just telling the story about the 110-year-old tortoise who got something. What was that, right? Have you read that story? 110, they're more than 100 years old, these tortoises or tortoises. Yeah. They were buddy, they were wife and husband for like 140, 10 years, 20 years, 80 years, 60 years. Right. And then one day she turned against him. One day she hated him. When the poor zoo people put them close to be friends, she bit his shell. And then even now they've got in separate houses and they're so sad, everybody wants them to be together. Everybody doesn't like divorces, you know, what really do we lovey-dovey? So they're trying every way to get these poor tortoises back together. And they even have a window in their house. And as soon as she sees him, she hisses like a snake. People are so unhappy. This is two tortoises. You're sad. Karma writes. Some old junk from the past that you haven't sorted out, but you can't see coming. You can't see the storm coming, you know. And some junk in the past we haven't sorted out, suddenly it manifests. And you're shocked, what's the thing going on? You don't know even why. That's how karma happens. So at this center, suddenly this harmony stuff was an amazing center. I can't tell you. So a community of 80 people. Lama Yeshe started this, he called it the Geshe program. He began a series of studies like we've got now, the master's program, the basic program. We've been doing our centers now. Lama started it back then. We had two main full-time lamas teaching. We had morning teachings every day. We had evening teachings every evening. It was incredible energy in this place. Amazing. I still remember it. Was it Bobby Cason that was there? We had about 40 Sangha there. It was dynamic and powerful and wonderful place. And then somehow something seemed to happen. It's hard to find the beginning though, you know. This new group started, then complaining about the director, and then meetings, then more talk behind backs. And all we mean well, we really mean well. People really mean well. Trying to make a place better, this is wrong, you know. And I remember one time, it was all sort of happening behind, you know. I wasn't necessarily totally involved in it all. I was working for Wisdom Publications at the time. I remember Lama Yeshe came one about this time. He'd give me a teaching, and suddenly he became so wrathful while shaking in my shoes, you know. And I'll never forget when he said, there's this particular group that want more democracy, you know, because they didn't like the way Harvey, who was the director, ran things. And he might have been a lousy director. I'm not saying he wasn't. And then I heard a lot of this. He said, you people in your democracy, many Western people, look where your democracy has got you. And then he said, if you want to help, you say, Harvey, what can I do? This is so hard. It's always about that. We want to have a say. We think the boss is too bossy. I know because I've been on the other end of it. The bossy one, who people complain about. Are we communicating here? So it was one of the worst experiences. It was like living in a war zone, you know, paranoia, behind backs and groups. And you sort of, no one intended it, something, but you sort of, it seems to almost have a life of its own. It's so fascinating, you know. Look what happens with families. And I mean, there's one mother now spread in somewhere, England, maybe in the States. There's a big fight over the husband and wife broken. Big fight between the parents about the children, the custody. This happens regularly. And the mother has been found, she found with three children. Out of anger and rage, and then this is happening. I mean, it's almost unbearable. It gets out of control. And now this is the point I'm getting. This is the point. We've all got anger. We've all got distress. We've all got jealousy and depression. But we don't have tools to work with it until it's vomiting out our mouth and we're drowning our babies. We don't have methods. And the suffering is so intense. And then the more you say it, the more you do it, the more you point fingers, the more violent and unbearable it becomes until you're drowning in insanity. And that's not as simple as this. We can see it. And then when you read sometimes about, you know, when you read about other people, this level of happiness, you think, how could it get to that level? So because we don't have techniques to deal with the jealousy, the pain, the distress, the anxiety, the anger, the hurt, the worries, the fears. And second, we can't distinguish what is true and what is not because we're overwhelmed by the delusions. This is the real point about the way these unhappy states of mind function. We can't distinguish fact from fiction. We cannot distinguish facts from fiction. And then it's all exacerbated by vomiting out and talking behind backs. And then it becomes more and more righteous and more concrete. You know, and then impossible to solve. I think we all recognize everywhere, in our families, at work, politics, places, organizations, human beings. Because the fact of the matter is, two people can be right. They can be right on both sides, but it's because we can't see the other person's right. It's impossible to do it. It's really hard to do, how to navigate it all, you know. So at least if we can try to control the thoughts, the speech. It doesn't mean you can't talk to somebody else. Find a therapist, please. Find a therapist. Or, often in groups and families, people don't like to confront each other. I'd rather people argue with each other and bring it out in the open, you know? But that's sometimes very painful for some people. That can be healthy if you have a genuine wish, if you have a sincere wish to solve the problem, a sincere wish to identify the problem. Some people never endingly vomit and fight, and it doesn't ever go. So you've got to have some wisdom, you know? And this, everybody does this. Everybody feels it. So one, to see the pain and suffering it causes ourselves should be enough to to help this one to start to catch. And then we've got the space, and after that, the miracle of the space to work on our mind. So I think basically part of our daily practice, meaning when you do 4 quantum powers, using the purification practice at the end of the day, if you're a Buddhist cancer practice, as Lama Zopa says, we're insane not to do it every day. And the fourth steps, the 4 hours, you regret the stuff. It's really psychologically very delicious practice. You can strip it all away from all the kind of seemingly ritual, kind of religious components, which you think of it as. It's a brilliant psychology. The 4 hours. It's like you being your own friend. So the 4 hours, you sit down at the end of the day before you get too sleepy. And you recall the things you've done that day with your body and speech to have others, very simple. And you regret them. So regret's a very tasty state of mind. It's not guilt. It's not I shouldn't have done it. It's not I'm bad. It's I did do it. Oh my God, I ate sugar today. And the reason you regret it is when you say to yourself, I regret having sugar. Guess what, Rabina? Because I don't want cancer. I mean, diabetes. I don't want the future result. So it's related to kindness to yourself. It's like compassion to yourself. I did do that. I did badmouth my sister. I did do that. I did, even if it's a tiny thing. And all that guilt we have, that kind of aching, bad feeling inside us we have, this is a powerful way of releasing that. I'd regret that because you're talking to yourself because you know what, Rabina, I'm sick of this bad habit. I'm sick of vomiting out my anger. I'm sick of this. We're discussing the habits, the behavior first, not your mind. You've got to be kind to yourself. I'm sick of this suffering. That's what's behind regret, not guilt, not I'm a bad person. You're talking to yourself. It's real good psychology, I tell you. You know, then you can say the things, whatever, that day, and then you can do it in a more extensive way, other stuff, blah, 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 and just talking simple. So then you think, well, who can I turn to? Where's the doctor? Who can give me methods that I can use to heal myself? Let's turn to the Buddha. He's our doctor. Good way to say. He's not our creator. He's not our boss. In this context, he's our mentor. Whom can I turn to? Whom can I rely on? Do you need the methods to help my mind, to help me? That's the Buddha. Then the second part of that second step, reliance, they call it, is now you have compassion for the person you harmed. And the sooner you do this, if you do this every day, it could not grow. It couldn't possibly. You have compassion for yourself. And then you have compassion. The second step is the compassion for the person you harmed. First for yourself. I regret this because I don't want the future suffering. This is very sincere, very real. And second, your compassion for the person you harmed. You must purify for their sake as well. Third step is you do the practice. So, of course, one might know this particular bit of meditation, where you visualize and so on and so forth. The fourth is resolve, the decision to change. If we don't do this, nothing changes. Having guilt, just twisting yourself up with being, I'm a bad person, doesn't help anything. So regret is a very wholesome attitude, very clean, very kind, because everything you think and do and say produces the person you become. So the fourth one, you know, if you've taken vows, you reiterate your vows, I will never kill, I will never this, blah, blah, blah. But this one, you know, say this particular action of bad-mouthing your sister or whatever, or even here you have compassion for the person you talked about. No, not so much your sister because she didn't hear it. When you're in the compassion bit, you have compassion for the person whose mind you disturbed by bad-mouthing your sister, you know, losing their mind. Then the fourth one is the resolve to change. And we know when you decide to do something, you will do it. We don't have confidence in this because we don't think our minds can change. We think we're set in stone. So this fourth step is you might say, you might not say, you know, you've got a vow never to kill. You say every day, I will not kill. But maybe you can't say, I will never badmouth my sister again. But you give yourself a timeline. Really intelligent. So you'll say for one day, 24 hours from today, I will not say one bad word about my sister to other people. You strongly decided. the morning you wake up, you remember it, and I promise you, you will keep it because you promised yourself. It's so intelligent. We just don't do it with such sincerity. We just kind of get all tangled and yielded and can't wait to go bad mouth again tomorrow. And then the story builds and builds and the dramas keep. No promise. There's no service statue. Then it will never get out of control. If you do this so sincerely every day, you won't get out of control. I promise. And then the whole thing is, okay, then what let's say there are problems, like at the center. You know, in the end, the Lama who was there, he's one of my teachers as well. You know, I'm not going to start giving facts. He took the center eventually. There's a big drama, a big schism happened. You know, Lama's ever said, in fact, it was from past life bad mouthing. He said it's from breaking our third group tantric vow in a past life, bad mouthing our five true brothers. So from 27 lives ago, the vomit picked up, you know, the vomit came. This big schism happened. This group took that center. Just, these are the facts, not criticism. I'm not being angry about it. It was a huge learning for my mind, being a Buddhist. I thought I'd take this teaching seriously. Bad mouthing behind backs. Speaking the thoughts, as someone else puts it. So often that can mean then misrepresented, misinterpreted as just being passive. It doesn't mean if there is a problem, you can't do something about it. Sometimes the problem is so huge, the best is divorce. You've got to accept the divorce. You understand? That's okay. Can't always fix it. But since that experience was one of the most painful experiences of my life, amazing center of incredible teachers, community-based people, splitting. But I have to say, I've tried my best. I have never said one bad word about that Lama and the group. Not one, ever, never. That's 40 years now. For my sake. For my sake. I don't want to pollute my mind. And that's hard for us in the West to be very righteous politically. We think if there are problems, we've got to speak them out with big banners. We think it's very honorable. It can be good to speak things out honorably with banners. It can be, but sometimes there's no benefit. You have to have the wisdom to know what the benefit is. So the thing in terms, one is having a fight with somebody and pointing out their faults, and then one is talking bad things about backs, behind backs, right? So the one talking about behind backs, it doesn't mean you can't describe a problem. If there really is a problem in that group, or that, say the family, and you're trying to discuss, you've got to have really sincere motivation to try and solve it, not just vomit. That's very, very difficult because it's very dangerous. It's easy to fall into the negative one. And equally with a person, there's nothing wrong with confronting a person and talking about it, but you've got to have sincere motivation to solve the problem. So many times people only talk behind backs. And even part of the problem is too, we don't even know what we think, because we're trying to all be good Buddhists, putting on a smiley face, not knowing what's festering inside, because we don't pay enough attention to our minds. We don't even know what's going on in our mind. None of this is easy to navigate, but this is daily practice. This is what practice is, for our own sake and the sake of others, you know. And the thing is, sometimes just the karma finishes. The divorce is there. Goodbye, baby. See you later. Finished. Over. Done. That's fine. Also, nothing wrong with that. We always think it's a failure, you know. We failed something. No, it can't end something. It's okay. So I don't know. I don't know why I took this tonight. It just happened. Are there any questions? Yes, we have.
Yes.
Well,
wait,
have the microphone, please. Yes, good idea. Yes, Bill, talk to me.
So listening to what you're saying, and I'm thinking about a situation that has arisen around me last week, where somebody was needing to vent, and I know that what she was going to say about these other people was entirely
true. Fix that to the mic, sorry.
I know what she's going to say about these other folk was entirely true.
Yeah.
Because we've seen the pattern.
Yeah, right.
And I'm thinking, okay, so who are listening, so she can vent.
Yes.
Trying to see where those other people are coming from.
Yes.
That doesn't necessarily solve the problem because it doesn't help them to see what they're doing.
No, that's like, not
I
exactly.
I agree with that. I'm just wondering.
We've got to have a listen to know. So one of the things is if somebody else is doing, I mean, we call it venting, is that somehow we need to, and that's one of the big, I suggest one of the big misconceptions in our modern society's view of the mind, because we know that some people do suppress. So that for that person, it is important to bring it up without fear. Some people have so much fear because they've been so dominated all their lives. They're terrified of expressing what they want. So it is good to have a good therapist, let's say, to give you the courage to speak up, whatever it might be. That's wonderful to solve the problem. But sometimes this is one that we think that venting kind of empties the tank. It doesn't. It just keeps filling the tank. It keeps creating more anger. So, okay, so what I'm getting at your answer, you have to have the wisdom to know what's going to be most beneficial for the person, at least in front of you. So if you feel that they're open, they say something, and you can sort of have a discussion, or even establish if they're a friend of yours, well, let's see if we really want to talk about this. Not just let a person vent for their own sake. Even establish, do you think it's good that we talk about this? Would you like to be able to find a way? Should we try and find a way we can understand it? And if they think it's being stupid, then, you know, I wouldn't waste my time. You have to just be wise. Well, I'm really got to go now. I'm so sorry, darling. I know you, blah. You know, to be wise. But if a person is open to discussion, to actually see things from another point of view, meaning someone else's beside your own, which is always the thing, it's fine, you know. You have to be wise. Isn't it not easy? No. It happens all the time, everywhere we go, isn't it?
Well, mediation's...
Microphone, darling. Keep the microphone there, please.
Sorry.
Just keep it within until we're finished, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, don't be sorry.
Well, I hadn't.
I know, that's right. Go on.
I was just thinking mediation works...
Mediation.
Mediation, you can do it together, or you can do it with a third person, but it works if both parties want to solve.
That's right, you've got to try to solve, yes.
If only one wants to and the other doesn't...
No, good at all.
The one no, that you still needs, maybe, I see what you think, to get it out of this system.
No, see, I don't believe this getting out of the system.
Right.
If somehow it's now finished. No, it just increases the anger. If it's anger. So being able to, some people don't know what we feel, so we need a sounding board. And that's like the therapist's job. But the person has to want to be able to hear their own thoughts so they can fix them.
Yeah.
That then vomit as much as you like because there's a benefit to it. Because you want to heal yourself. You want to work it out.
Yeah.
That's necessary. And I think the reason we have that is because we don't know how to do it ourselves because it's not part of our education, quite sincerely.
So we're working on this.
Yes, exactly. So you just and so it's really it is really it's a minefield.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Full point.
Yes, please. Thank you. Someone online has a question,
sweetheart.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah, how's it going?
Go. Yeah, please
go. I came from a very strict Catholic.
Big question, darling.
I came from a very strict Catholic background.
Yes.
And for many, many years, I had a lot of fear, like of going to hell.
Fear of being punished, fear of, yes, yeah, consequences, yeah. Yes, yes.
I've lost that fear now.
You've lost that fear now.
I have lost that
fear. Okay.
But a lot of my friends are still in that situation.
You have a friend who still feels like that.
Yeah, they think that at best they're going to get a purgatory.
I understand.
It's terrible.
So the fear of being punished is really the point, isn't it? The fear that someone's going to punish you. No?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And, I'm just wondering, in Tibetan Buddhism, do you think the world would be better off now than these religions?
You see, it's very interesting. I think the main point about when we think of religion, because it's a creator religion, and I think it's a good way to see it, I'm not criticizing anybody who's got faith in a creator, but we can easily misuse it and make it fundamentalist with like a big stick, right? I mean, that kind of fundamentalism is exactly the same in a communist country where there's no religion. It's exactly the same. This heavy, threatening, heavy policeman attitude, like a boss. So we become coward and fearful to say anything or do anything. Well, that's the problem.
I mean, in mass, to get on their knees.
In what?
In mass, to get on their knees and say, Lord, I'm not worthy that you should enter my roof. And it just feels like... everything's relied on him, not on ourselves.
Everything's what?
Relied on him, and not
God, us. You mean?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so I know there's a whole bunch of things here, so let's just discuss it. Each person's different. So the fact is, as a Catholic, I loved God. I never felt guilty. I never felt that fear. I never worried about going to hell. I loved God. I thought God was everywhere. I loved Our Lady. I loved the saints. I went to Mass every day. I said my prayers. I said it in Latin. I was the wickedest, naughtiest kid, though. I was the worst kid in the school and the family, but these two parts of me lived together. So I'm really just saying this. I never had that problem you had because we're different personalities. So I can see the benefit of anybody who's got real devotion in God that could cause them to become happy and joyful and live a good life. Oh. But hang on, sweetheart. But I also know exactly what you're saying. If we're kind of become cowed by it and fearful and people are brutalizing us and we live in fear of someone, and I think the point I want to make here is fear of being punished. I want to say this point.
Yes.
So now let's say that the Buddhist view is there's no punisher and there's no rewarder. Buddhism also has views that our own negative actions will produce our future suffering. And that can sound just the same. But if you, for example, go to the doctor and she says, don't smoke, mate, and she shows you videos of hideous cancerous lungs, you don't freak out in fear and live in cowering terror that she's going to give you cancer. That's the punishment one. You thank her for her kindness in waking you up to the terrible dangers to yourself of your smoking.
Can so I just jump in for a second?
What, darling?
I get my mind really on this.
Yeah, you get so. What?
Can I just jump in for a second?
First of all, the only reason I said this to you is to hopefully hear it. The point isn't whether it's hell or heaven or it's the punishment and the fear of displeasing somebody.
Yes.
That's the neurotic part.
Well, I'll be looking up too on YouTube and stuff about how all religions lead to the same end.
They all what?
How all religions lead to the same ending.
What's that ending? What does that say? Well, what's that?
Some say love, some say enlightenment.
Oh, you mean the good part of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, they all come. It's a philosophy that is a method of helping you become a better person, right? Marvelous, yes. So then your point is? So then?
Well, I don't think you can believe in all religions at the same time.
I mean, I suggest you don't believe in any. Don't believe in it. See if there's something useful in it and do it.
Well,
don't believe.
I come here. I haven't been here for a while.
Yeah.
But to be perfectly honest, I don't know what the answers are.
No, I understand.
But I'm seeking. And
that's right.
Yeah.
That's good. So you have to keep seeking because you're the boss, you know.
I believe everybody is basically insane.
Okay. So that if that helps you knowing that, then find a solution. But your job is to try and find your solution, isn't
exactly,
it? So you feel like you're moving forward, you're finding some useful advice in some place. Keep moving, sweetheart.
Yeah.
You're doing the right thing. You're the boss.
Exactly.
You're the boss. You create yourself, and you have to turn yourself into a happy person and not turn yourself into a suffering person. It's up to you to find the methods.
Yeah.
So keep moving, sweetheart.
Thank you.
Well done.
Yep.
There he is. Thank talk you. To me now. Talk.
It's just a quick one. Is our ability to communicate related to our karma?
Why don't you ask that in a slightly more unpacked way? I don't quite get the question.
Well, I think that sometimes I can't express myself. I say wrong sentence, which is completely wrong. It's like no clarity.
Oh, I see. Yes. Well, that can be very much, some of us really stumble with our words and don't express ourselves clearly. I think it's just some habit maybe, you know, or I think it's just really a habit, whether you get angry easily, whether you play the piano easily, whether you play football easily, or whether you don't. So I think it's just some habit, and there are methods we can use to work on it, to get clarity, to get wisdom. Even one of the mantras we do, the Manjushri mantra, is to help us get clarity of speech. So maybe you should do that one. No, that's definitely, of course it is. Certain tendency you have, yes. Yes.
But is it related to karma?
That's what I'm saying. It's a habit. Karma means habit.
Okay.
It's a habit. You bring into this life, you program with your different habits. Maybe you find football very easily, but you find cooking difficult. You find, you know, other habits easily, but the speech one is a struggle. Of course it is. Yes, they're a bunch of habits. And one way karma ripens is habits. Yes, exactly.
But we can still work on it.
What, my dear?
But we can still work on it.
Absolutely. Yes, that's the point. Exactly. So if you say the Manjushri mantra, maybe that's a good one to clarify your speech. The mantra of wisdom, the Buddha of wisdom.
Thank you.
Okay. What else? What else, people? Yes. The Catholic. The ex-Catholic. The seeker. What's your question this time? Oh, somebody else here first. You in a minute, darling. You next. Yes.
Venerable, they say that you should watch your thoughts because your thoughts become your speech.
That's right.
Watch your action speech because it becomes your habit.
There you go. Very nice. That's perfect. And I don't even want to say that did that.
My question is, how the heck do you control your thoughts?
You have to control the speech. Okay. Would you agree that if there were no thoughts, there'd be no speech, would there?
That's right.
Speech is simply a verbalizing of thoughts. Well, obviously, the grosser level is the verbalizing. But our trouble is we don't see our thoughts. We don't pay attention to our thoughts. It is not our system. We're now beginning maybe with some kind of mindfulness in the West, people liking it more. We don't have that technique. This is the key technique that Buddha gives us from 2,000 years. There are brilliant techniques for us to start the day and then practice throughout the day, methods of learning to train the mind to stay focused, training the mind to step back, and then slowly learning, once we open our eyes and come back to daily life, to become more aware of what the hell is going on in here before it gets to the mouth. But still, the practice is to, so there you are. So let's say before you never noticed what you thought, and yet you've got this hubby who keeps spilling his tea and annoys you, and you don't say much, but it builds up one day and then you blurt it out, right? So now, so then you start a bit of a practice. So you start to decide, I'm not going to want to blurt out every word. So you have a practice where even you start a few minutes every day where you step back and you're saying you do mindfulness meditation, just watching your boring old breath. What you're actually doing there is training yourself not to sink into all your thoughts. Do you understand? You step out of your thoughts, if you like, and you can't help but see them. They're all raging on, but you don't pay attention. So you can't help but see them. So that the skill you learn from training yourself, even for 5 minutes, to stay on your boring old breath, it's a training. Do you hear me? Is when you bring that to bear and you're in the kitchen, and now because you've been training yourself to focus, you can't help but hear the thoughts, not just the slurping of the tea and feeling irritated but not being conscious of it. You become more conscious of the irritation before it becomes emotional, and then you're able to talk to yourself. Well, honey child, it's only slurping. Give the man a break. It's all right. And before you know it, you don't say the words. So you are working on your mind, but the main one is to control the speech. You still might be feeling annoyed, but you're really making a decision not to say the words. This is so tremendous. But it's you're working with your mind. The first one is mainly control the speech. And then eventually, when you've really got that harnessed, you really can now have more space to drill down more deeply to unpack and unravel all the conceptual stories. Layers of them. I mean, the level to which we can go deeply in our minds in the Buddhist psychological model is insanely more subtle than we ever think in modern psychology, honestly. And the techniques are all there, and we are capable.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yes, what's your question?
Well, basically, every religion, most people think they have all the answers.
What's your question, darling? Well, it's good to get a question. Get it out, right?
I have a question.
Good, sweetheart. Say the question.
Well, why does anything exist?
Come on, honey. Try and bring it down to earth. That's your darling man. You're seeking. You're trying to find a way to see the world.
Yeah.
Keep moving, reading. Try to be optimistic.
I have been.
Well, then, sweetheart, don't be so anxious about it. Relax and enjoy the process. Read, go to places. Don't be so worried about it. You're still who you are. Try and live a good life. Try and be a nice guy. Try and make yourself, try and feel confident in yourself. Rejoice in your good qualities. Delight every day. And just keep moving, and it will slowly unfold.
Okay.
Don't have to ask such agonizing questions. Just try to find a way to be a better human being and more content and more kind to others. That's a good start, darling. What do you think? What do you think about that?
Well,
is that good advice or not? What do you think?
Yeah,
pretty good. Huh? Give me the mic. What do you think? I'm sincere now. What do you think of that advice?
Well, everybody seems to think...
Sweetheart, what do you think of that advice for you, sweetie pie, petal, dear friend, for you? Don't be so big and grand ideas. It doesn't keep on the earth. Look at yourself. Feel you know you've got marvelous potential as a human being. Try to find the way to be more happy. Try to find the way to be kinder to others. And then from this, it will come slowly.
All right.
And that's the feeling I have. Start on the earth. Be humble. Do you understand, darling?
Yeah, thank you.
You do. I'm happy. So keep moving. What's your name, sweetheart?
Ross.
Why don't you keep moving, right? Well,
yeah.
Are you moving? Keep moving.
Yeah.
I'm good, darling. Just keep being brave.
I can definitely hear what you were saying when this lady was asking the question about a friend needing to vent or to talk to her, and we need the wisdom to know how to help a person in that situation. And it's really hard when we don't have that wisdom and life is coming at us at 1,000 miles an hour and it's hard to know what to do. And I wonder, obviously, you keep working on your mind to get that wisdom, but what do we do in the meantime when stuff
people? Okay, it's a bit like asking me, you know nothing about health, you don't even know how to apply a band-aid, and people are coming all over the place with broken legs and blood and hits on their heads. Honey, you only can apply what wisdom you've got one step at a time. You know, at least you start with a band-aid, and that's as much as you know, so you don't do more. You do what you can. And then when you see the suffering, you go, I better keep learning. I better get more wisdom. And it's incremental and gradual, darling. And so you protect yourself. If you can't handle and can't help all the crazy people, you have to keep out of their way because you go mad. So you have to be wise in who you hang out with, wise the friends you have, wise the places you go, because you can't handle all this crazy, using the analogy of people with broken heads and broken bodies and blood everywhere. I'm talking about the mental side. If you can't handle it, you've got to know this is why people go crazy, because they can't handle it, because we don't have the wisdom to know how to even help one person. So we have to have the self-respect to know how to live our lives, who to hang out with, where to go, what to do. We have to do this to protect ourselves as we develop more wisdom. And then we get braver and braver. And by the time you get to be like the bodhisattvas, they love them. They love living in maniac New York and London and Beirut and the craziest places. It's grist for their mill because they're capable. What do you think?
I can't wait to get to that point.
So one step at a time. One step at a time. Know where you're at. Be content with it. Know that you are a work in progress. Know there are methods. Know you have a map and a path and go one step at a time, one step at a time, one step at a time. And then as you increase your own wisdom about who you are and your suffering, that enables you to help others. A little bit one step at a time. I'm sorry, Miffy, I'm trying to be good. One step at a time, okay? You see, go on. Yeah, okay. Go on. Yes, here, go speak up.
I have a very volatile and drama-filled family.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sorry, Miss Webb. And I've stepped back from the hood.
Yes.
For protection for myself.
Yes.
But also for I don't want to create anything that's
perfect.
Going to come.
So perfect.
But I've now been very much accused of being attacked.
By them.
By then. And, yeah. You know, some of the crazy things that have been said. Is silence an okay way?
I understand. This is easy. Okay. Groups, close groups, friends, families, as soon as we stop playing the usual way with each other, let's say you decided to step back or you decide to control your speech. Of course, naturally, the other people are going to be threatened by this. They're going to accuse you of being mean, so there they are accusing you. So you've got to stay stable and fulfilled and content and trust your decision and let them think what they like. That's the answer. You've got to stay steady in your decision. You said the words you said were perfect for your own sake and for their sake. You don't have to tell them that. It's not their business. Tell them you love them, but you're really busy. Say whatever. But they're going to keep talking about you. They're going to have a view no matter what. That's what some people do. They're never satisfied. You can't make them happy. Love them for who they are and allow them to have their opinion, knowing it's not who you are. That takes courage, but you have to do that. What do you think?
Yeah.
Don't try to defend yourself. Tell them you love them. Mm-hmm. That's it. Don't defend. Because when a person's lashing out at you because they're feeling jealous or resentful, no answer will help.
No.
Nothing will help. So just love them. Go past it. Don't be passive aggressive. Love them. I love them for who they are.
And it's okay to step back,
isn't it? I'm saying that. That's what I said to her. Absolutely. You have to. If you're a honey child, if you're attached to alcohol, you'd be considered ridiculous if you didn't step back from alcohol. Come on. This is where we know that about alcohol, let's say, but we don't understand that about other people. So we put all our open hearts, like we're so wearing our hearts on our sleeves, and then leap into people, and we wonder why we get abused and harmed by each other, because we're all crazy, we're all attached, we're all angry, we're all resentful. We've got to protect ourselves. You need to choose where you go and whom you hang out with, and you will be criticized, yes. But out of passive aggression, no. Many people, you know, give up their family because they're bored with tears and have no empathy. That's horrible. That's just self-centeredness and anger. So not ever, not that motivation. Never that. Yes, sorry, talk to me. Say it again.
What? I had a nice slogan that you said, and I wasn't quick enough to write.
What's the slogan?
It was something along the lines of habits don't get worse.
Oh, okay, I'd love you to... The Tibetan saying, a lovely Tibetan saying, for what we say is practice makes perfect. Uh-huh. They say nothing ever gets more difficult with practice. It's very sweet, humble, more humble, isn't it? Nothing ever gets more difficult with practice. I love that.
That's
beautiful. Isn't it nice? So it gives us courage. Isn't it? Nothing ever gets more difficult. So where are we then? Okay. The point is the mind. It's the whole Buddha's deal. Is the mind. It's no question. But because it goes to such subtle levels, and this is again the point, the Buddha's way of analysing the mind is so, it goes to such depth, such subtleness, the levels and levels and levels and levels and levels and levels of even just conceptuality, of the stories in our head. There's layers and layers and layers, and they're just conceptual stories. They're all raging on. I think even in the West we say there's like 1,000 thoughts a second. Buddha would totally agree. And this is what's incredible in Buddhism. It sounds like science fiction to us. These ingenious Indians, more than 3,000 years ago, are the ones who invented this brilliant psychological skill, the likes of which do not even remotely exist in modern neuroscience or psychology. That's why we're all learning from them now, starting to realize we're not, you know, we're not the ant's pants. But Freud didn't invent the mind or psychotherapy. Buddha doesn't speak Greek, that's all. This brilliant technique that even if we have some semblance of familiarity with it, vaguely the world calls it mindfulness, but it's based on this brilliant technique called single-pointed concentration. It's a method of developing some level of concentration, some sharpness that enables us to actually begin to control in an effortless way the millions of thoughts and to unpack and unravel them and make sense to them. Right now, there's a great big emotional soup in there. We can't tell one bit from another until it vomits out the math. We can learn by using the skill and by using understanding this particular model of the mind, and that's up to us. You know, forced, you can use your thought, it's up to you. I'm talking Buddha here. We've got incredible potential to know our minds and learn to be in charge of them. I mean, can you imagine? It's all there. It's up to us in one of these methods. We don't have confidence because we don't believe such a thing is possible. I mean, for example, we always think in the West, I mean, I heard recently people say, oh, some traumas, you'll never get over them. We talk about that. This is totally, I mean, so unbelievable. The Buddha says he can get rid of all delusions, upheaving altogether, totally and completely. With you so dangly optimistic, you can't believe it. There's nothing we can't change in our mind. There's nothing we can't unpack and unravel and delve deep in and sort out and confront and see and go beyond. There is nothing. I can go on at once. But have the courage to do it, you know, with optimism. But not just crossing your fingers, it's techniques to learn, you know. sort of highly sophisticated system, the way of seeing the mind, the model of the mind, the analysis of the way the mind works. It's quite precise, quite unique to the Buddha. And because it's 2,500 years old, that made it boring. We're only catching up with it now, I would suggest. I think in our culture, seeing the genius of these Indians, as Antonio says, it was these Indians more than 3,000 years ago were the ones who began the investigation into the nature of self. So much more published there, incredible knowledge, showing this vast body of knowledge that's out there. There's nothing to do with belief. It's about the mind, the mind. There's other stuff in Buddhism, of course, but about the mind, the way it works, and what we can do with it, the potential we have. And that's encouraging.
Yes, I have a question.
Cassandra. Cassandra, talk to me, sweetheart.
If our karma is ripening and things might be going wrong and we don't understand why, is the view then that it's a great opportunity to apply these sort of techniques to see our way through it?
That's the way makes any sense. In your life, yes. Because if you use this view of karma, which is the Buddhist of the law that runs the universe, a natural law. If we use this view and the analogy of seeds and fruits, which is exactly the analogy Buddha uses, of every millisecond of what arises in your life, it's not just occasionally karma ripens. If you have a garden, every second something is ripening, isn't there? Something is coming. Is it a weed or a flower or a herb? Would you agree with that? Every second something is ripening. So then what life is learning to know how to interpret it and how to ensure that if it's the rubbish, you don't repeat it. Like you make sure you don't grow more weeds. You understand the nature of the weeds. You identify them and you can pull them out and you can stop growing more weeds. And then you can navigate the whole crazy garden by doing the weeding and growing the flowers and growing the herbs. That's the perfect analogy of what living your life is, using Buddhism as your basis. Every second karma is ripening. So every second you have a pleasant feeling. Every second people are kind to you, you get money in the bank, you get a job, you feel healthy. That's not just life. That's karma ripening, honey, and it's virtuous karma ripening. And every second suffering, unhappiness, bad-mouthing, hubby leaving you, pain in the knee, that's your negative karma ripening. We tend to only think of karma as negative, which is schizophrenic. Everything in your life is your karma ripening. How you learn to interpret it and deal with it is how you live your life. That's life. That's being a Buddhist. You with me?
Mm.
You are. Good. Yes. It's a dynamic way. This is the basis of being a Buddhist. You know, do you understand? You have to learn about the law of karma and you learn about the mind. They're the two main components. That's it. They're the tools you use. That's it. That's being a Buddhist, honey. And your success in the very first level is at least don't sow more weeds. The first level of practice. At least stop growing more weeds, for God's sake. Not even discussion about growing flowers yet. At least don't grow more weeds. Next one, purify the weeds you've already planted before they ripen. This gradual organic process. Then you start to actively grow now. The good flowers, you practice the compassion wing. So this is, it's like a logical step by step by step.
Can you maybe explain a little bit? I've heard people tell me about collective karma, like when terrible things happen to people, you know, atrocities in the world, like women are raped, people are murdered, those kinds of things. We find it hard to understand about, is it that it's not that person's fault that's happened to them,
their
karma. It's more like a collective karma or something.
I understand. Okay. The Buddha, like I said before, just now to Cassandra, the Buddha's view is every millisecond of whatever happens or arises in the mind of every single being in the universe, the monkeys, dogs, humans, ants, and all the others as well as humans, every millisecond, something is ripening, either happiness or suffering, speaking simply. Every millisecond, each being, both as individuals and as groups, we are experiencing the fruits of past seeds. Can you hear that concept? Can you hear that concept? You don't sound very confident.
Well,
what do you hear me say? What are you hearing me say? Say it in your words.
I guess my words would interpret
what I just said now.
The things that happen, say, to me as an individual, I've caused them to occur. I've caused it to happen.
Every millisecond of what any being experiences moment by moment by moment by moment, whether you call it happy things or suffering things, is necessarily the fruit of seeds you have planted in the past. Think of your garden, and it's exactly like that. A garden is full of weeds and herbs and flowers. Everything growing in your garden is only the fruit of seeds you put in your garden, isn't it? Can you hear that? Why you can't hear that?
I'm struggling.
Don't try to even extrapolate. Can you hear the logic of a garden? Whatever's in that garden, you know the seeds must have been planted in the past. Do you accept that?
By me?
Do you accept if it's your garden? Use the analogy. If it's your garden, then you must have planted the seeds. Take that as the principle. So whatever is growing in your garden, you must have planted it. And that's the analogy. Everything that happens in an individual's life, every moment, necessarily is the fruit of things they have done in the past. We are the creators of our own experiences of happiness and suffering. Our mind goes back and back and back. I mean, this is the Buddha's view, and the only way to understand how that's possible is if you take the view, even as a hypothesis, that everybody's consciousness is going back and back and back and back and back. The only way it makes sense is that. That's the view of the Buddha's. That's the Buddhist view of the universe. Are you hearing me? Simply the concepts. Can you hear the concept?
I'm not
asking you to believe it, darling. I'm not asking you to squeeze it down your throat. I'm just telling you the Buddha's view, just so you can hear it in a very relaxed way, intellectually. I'm not asking you to believe it. I'm just asking you to hear it.
My question is...
What your question is. I'm about to answer it, but I want you to go one step at a time. I want you to acknowledge each point as I go, so we're communicating. Simple principle first.
Yes, I've got that part, yes.
Good. Now, the next step is, you know, we all live in groups, don't we? We're humans and animals. We all live in... We're very social beings. Would you agree with that? Do you agree with that?
Yes.
And you see that we all do things together. So you can see a whole country might have agree with and have a war with another country. A whole group of people might be very harmonious and love the other country. We do things in groups.
Yeah.
We're very group-oriented. So we create karma in groups. Right. So we will experience the fruits of those in groups. A family is a group. A country is a group. Men is a group. Females are a group, a dog, there's all lots of groups. We have similarities. So some group of people might have a really wonderful village that's very harmonious, everybody has a job, lovely weather, the houses are nice, nobody steals, no one lies. That's the collective karma of their own practice of past virtue and goodness and harmony and not stealing and not killing. So then another group can be bombed. That's the collective karma of the actions of that group from 1,000 lifetimes ago from having harmed as a group, roughly the way to put it. So nothing in the Buddhist view of karma, it's no creator, there's no punisher, there's no rewarder, it's not random, it's a natural law. Of course, this is shocking because we do not think like this. This is the Buddhist view. Can you hear?
I hear.
The next question is: How do you use this as the basis of your life? How do you work with this? So then, like the garden, you take responsibility for whatever's there, knowing you planted it. You delight in the good things and want to keep growing more, and you acknowledge the negative and stop growing them because you don't want more suffering. That's the attitude.
Yes, I understand that for myself, and that's a way for.
I can't hear. Go closer to the mic. Look at the mic into your mouth. John, darling, you understand what?
Yes, I understand it for myself and as a way of behaving and, you know.
That's right. This is not just for your garden, it's everybody's, it's a law.
Yeah.
It applies to everybody, darling.
Yeah. The hard thing I find to understand about it is, say, when Australia.
Yes,
colonized,
right. And yes, exactly.
The British came and raped and murdered, yeah, and massacred.
Exactly. They did.
Innocent. Yes. Yeah. People,
yeah, exactly.
It kind of sounds like it was the Aboriginal people's fault when we think of it like this.
And I understand it. So what about the other side of it? What about, can you see sometimes in the world good things happen? Have you noticed some groups experience good things? Can you see that?
Yes.
So is that unfair as well? I mean, do you find it hard to imagine that group must have created virtuous karma in the past?
No. I have to think about that.
That's right, exactly, because we only ever ask when it comes to the bad things. Because, you see, underneath the question is an assumption that somehow if, you know, that we're sort of, that we take it as blame and punishment. There's no such concept. If you think of it as a natural law, like as a natural law that if you smoke cigarettes, you'll get cancer. That's a natural law. No one's punishing you. It's a law. And if you discover that, then you'll try to stop smoking.
Mm. Mm-mm.
So of course, suffering, yes, suffering is the fruit of similar actions in the past. Happiness is the fruit of similar actions in the past. That's the principle. So all we can do is look into this. It's really very different from how we see the world. This has been around for 3,000 years, this view. It's just been taken as a given in some cultures. Mm-hmm. So this is the Buddha's view about why things happen. I know exactly. I understand your question, whether it's a group of people suffering, being abused. I mean, this is, you see, the interesting point doesn't mean, what it means is we do things, we harm each other. Groups harm, individuals harm. And each of those people, the victim in that group, in that relationship is being abused now, must have abused in the past. And the person doing the abuse now will be the victim in the future. We kind of, it goes around, it's sort of kind of, we all get what we give, you know. I mean, sort of you sow the seeds and get the fruits. So all the suffering is the fruit of our negativity and all the happiness is the fruit of our positivity. It's kind of a simple principle, but hard to get it because it's not the view we tend to have. Mm. I mean, we can do what we like. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Time to go, isn't it? Time to finish. Yeah. Time to finish. So we think, okay, is anything useful? I don't know what topic popped up or died yet. It was useful.
Yeah.
So make a decision tonight. Make a decision tonight. Regret your rubbish today, your bad mouth. You just go blur, blur, blur. You know, you think you said some foolish word. You feel embarrassed. Just regret the blur out of our mouths. The things we've said about the bad, the proud, the lousy politicians, whatever. Just regret, because you just think of the pain. You're sick of the suffering. And you don't want to hurt it. So regret it tonight and think. And then I'll decide tomorrow. 24 hours, I'll do my best to watch my speech like a hawk. You'll be so happy if by the end of the day you didn't see one bad word. Honestly, you really will, I promise. And then when you do that, like I said with my family, that's a surprise. It now is giving space for the pleasure and the joys the since our sister died, you know, all together, all dynamic, everyone got different views. We didn't fight once. Everything worked beautifully. We're really doing our best to be harmonious. It really pays, I tell you. Are we communicating?
Yeah.
To see it as benefit for yourself. Yeah. And know you can. All right, that's my advice. So this is a prayer. Let compassion grow and grow in the hearts of all. Chum chug, sem chug, rinpoche, ma ke pa nam ke gyu chi, ke pa nyam pa me pa nyam, gong ne gong ju, pa ba shi. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very much, everybody.